American Literature Pre-Discussion Podcast Number 8, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Transcendentalism. Ralph Waldo Emerson was a public intellectual, a speaker and essayist and a poet, but his greatest contribution to American intellectual life is as a philosopher. In this pre-discussion podcast, we'll get ready to discuss Nature, Emerson's first published book. That book helped found the Transcendentalist movement. Whilst the abstract question occupies your intellect, nature brings it in the concrete to be solved by your hands. That's from the last chapter of Nature. Let's unpack it. Okay, an abstract concept such as bravery can occupy your intellect, but we can't act on abstract concepts. That's where the poet steps in. Poets use metaphors, Emerson tells us, these elaborate comparisons, in order to address an abstract concept in a concrete manner. So we have the lion's courage, or the fox's cunning, or the mother bear's devotion. All of these are concrete images that sort of shade the bland and abstract concept of bravery. Emerson insists that everything about nature is poetic, and once you understand nature, you can read its moral lessons to better your lot in life and improve the world and know the mind of God. Emerson was the son of a Unitarian minister. His father died when Emerson was young, and though the family was poor, his mother and aunt kept him intellectually stimulated. Perhaps the fact that he learned so much through female authority figures may have predisposed him to see the world a little bit differently. Transcendentalism, like most abstract terms, has many shades of meaning. Emerson himself said his focus was the infinitude of the private man, that focus on the richness of the individual life is very much a staple of American identity even today. Some of the early American literary classics in the early 1800s wrestle with the fact that in those days, America clearly rejected the old world, but American art and literature was spending so much time rejecting the old world that even that rejection defined who you were. It made America depend so much on having something to reject in order to have an identity that they really had not founded their own individual identity. Some early American literature before Emerson focuses on confusion and uncertainty. For instance, Rip Van Winkle is baffled by post-revolutionary America, and in The Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key's speaker is peering through the gloom, uncertain of what he sees. Emerson had a hand in the formation of some key American myths. Chief among them are national fixation on individuality. Generations later, we have the Lone Ranger, the rags-to-riches myth, the solitary cabin in the woods, and the lone motorcyclist on the open road. These are our cultural myths. They're shared, they're deeply woven into the fabric of the American dream. But those myths have not been the myths of every culture at every time. Let's consider the medieval knight. In his full armor, he can barely walk. He gets strapped into a harness and hoisted up onto his horse, and an assistant hands him his lance. Now, when I put it that way, he seems silly. But in his day, nobody minded that the knight needed so much help. Life was communal. Anyone who tried to be an individual in medieval culture was at a deep disadvantage. Transcendentalism may be seen as part of the American Romantic movement, but this celebration of emotion and passion that's characteristic of Romantics, that didn't just pop up from nowhere. It was a reaction against an existing, a more scientific mode of thought. It was a reaction against the certainty and fixity and logic of the Enlightenment. So the Romantics celebrated emotion because they thought of themselves as correcting the errors of the Enlightenment. Now, but if you went to those people who named their era the Enlightenment, they would tell you that too much emotion was a bad thing and that certainty and fixity and logic were all good things. They would say that their focus on logic was an improvement over the fear and blind superstition and corruption of what they called the Dark Age. Get it? Enlightenment? Dark Age? Now, in their turn, if you go back to the so-called Dark Ages, the medieval times, those medieval people who just helped put that knight on his horse and were cheering during his jousts, they wouldn't say they lived in a dark age. They would look around them and see great cathedrals and tapestries and art, and they would see this unity with God and this compassion for their fellow Christians. They would see a society that was far superior to the bloody gladiator games and the throwing of slaves to the lions that went on during classical heathenish Roman times. Oh, and if you spoke to those Romans, okay, well, you get the idea. Every movement is a reaction against some other movement, remixing and recalibrating the way that humans understand the world. Emerson saw this too. Emerson saw that American creative and intellectual life, or what passed for it at the time, it was just an echo chamber of Europe, which was itself an echo chamber of its own past. Americans had boldly broken away from Mother England, and Emerson said it was about time that Americans broke artistically and philosophically and spiritually away as well. Now, reason is perfectly good. Emerson accepts reason, enjoys reason, but he notes that humans also have this innate capacity for imagination, for fancy, for intuition, for faith. These mark us as human just as much as logic marks us as human, and to suppress those parts of our nature for the sake of logic was just asking too much. Now, Emerson burst onto the American intellectual scene by more or less, well, kind of inventing that American intellectual scene. I mean, literally, he collected around him a group of like-minded intellectuals and said, okay, guys, let's be America's intellectual foundation. They played out this group in their careers, this same search for American identity. Now, Emerson's first publication, Nature, calls for a distinctly American way of looking at these enduring questions of human existence. You might expect from a book with the title Nature that Emerson's going to be writing about rainbows and butterflies, but you get a better idea when you see that right away Emerson divides the universe into the soul and everything else, and he labels that everything else part nature. For Emerson, nature was the visible mind of God, and its purpose, the purpose of creation, is to reveal to us truths about our souls. Emerson rejected the received wisdom he found in books and traditions because when he looked at his own world, you know, he saw he was living in a nation that celebrated freedom but permitted slavery. He himself had learned all about politics in a household of women who themselves couldn't vote. He realized that what he read, what he knew, did not help him to understand America. In certain ways, Emerson was the opposite of Emily Dickinson. Emerson traveled. He went to North Carolina, to Florida. He went across Europe. Dickinson stayed put. Emerson published books. He delivered hundreds of public lectures. He was celebrated in his lifetime and attacked during his lifetime. Emily Dickinson shared her ideas with a very small circle of intimates during her lifetime. There are references to Dickinson owning copies of various works by Emerson, and in fact, her mentor and editor, Colonel Higginson, was a member of Emerson's group of intellectual transcendentalists. Emerson at one point spoke in Amherst, that's Emily Dickinson's hometown, and he in fact even visited Austin Dickinson's house. This is the house of Emily's brother who lived next door to her. I have not seen any evidence that Emerson and Dickinson actually met. Remember, Dickinson did not meet very many visitors at all, so it's very possible that if Emerson came to Austin Dickinson's house, Emily may have stayed in the hallway and listened to the conversation, but I have not found any evidence about that. Even if we don't have any evidence that Emerson and Dickinson ever had a conversation, we can certainly interpret Dickinson's poetry in light of Emerson's philosophy. Dickinson, however, is not considered a transcendentalist. She was not one of his followers. She was just too independent and too private for that. Emerson's Nature begins with an introduction that complains that our age builds upon the sepulchres of the fathers. Now, that's his poetic way of making a concrete statement to make an abstract point. His point is that obsession with its own corrupt past makes Europe incapable of progress. He makes that abstract statement into this concrete image about building on a grave. Now, according to Emerson, there is no reason to write or read a poem about nature unless that poem illuminates something about humanity. A poem is not a record of the poet's internal thoughts. A poem is a way of understanding human nature through the outside world. Speaking to his fellow Americans, Emerson writes, "These are new lands, new men, new thoughts. Let us demand our own works and laws and worship." In the chapter on beauty, Emerson argues that nature serves man's love of beauty. For Emerson, beauty is not just delight in recognizing and repeating these natural shapes. Beauty is also, according to Emerson, the mark God sets on virtue. In Emerson here, we have a detailed explanation of why, in literature, rain is never just rain, but always, always a symbol for us to read. It's a symbol out there in nature all the time, not just a symbol when it appears in a poem. We are, as humans, built to find meaning in our environment, and Emerson encourages us through our poetry and our philosophy to make full use of this human tendency. In the chapter Language, Emerson notes that an enraged man is a lion, a cunning man is a fox, a firm man is a rock, a learned man is a torch. He says this is not just a happy accident, a little poetic flourish. He says that every thought we think has been borrowed from the physical, natural world. Every word we speak is a metaphor. Every concept we can think, even in science or math, is poetry. Because as humans, we think by analogy, and the first things we ever spoke about was nature, and everything else we've spoken about since then has built upon those first observations of nature. An ant is just an ant, according to Emerson, but when we apply the habits of the ant to a moral lesson, for instance, we observe ants work all the time, so we can praise the industrious ant in a poem, and thereby the ant becomes a model of human virtue. It's that poem that gives the ant a purpose to teach us something about ourselves, about why industriousness is a good thing. Nature is the source of every word or concept that we can imagine, and the poet encounters truths in nature more readily than in the city. Nature is bursting with moral lessons for us to discover, to hear Emerson tell it, because when we read nature, we're reading the mind of God. Herman Melville, who is known as something of an anti-transcendentalist, didn't quite buy this love of nature thing. You can see him poking a little bit of fun at this concept in Bartleby the Scrivener. The narrator at one point imagines that his purpose in life is to furnish space for Bartleby to occupy, which places the narrator in the role of a god who longs for the acknowledgement and praise of his creation. But even more directly, when the narrator visits Bartleby in prison and tries to cheer him up, he says, "Look, you can see the grass, you can see the sky." And Bartleby replies, "I know where I am." His deadpan certainty that he's in prison is not in the slightest elevated by his exposure to nature. Emerson, however, concludes his book Nature by calling for a union of the rational study of science and the intuitive exploration of the soul. He suggests for us the faithful thinker will embody the love of science and the love of poetry. The faithful thinker will kindle science with the fire of the holiest affections. Now, Emerson does not see science and poetry as equal. Far from it. Poetry is a superior vehicle for exploring the lessons of nature. But when you put it in context, remember, Emerson is writing against a vision of the Enlightenment that insisted science was the highest form of knowing and rejected all art as inferior. So Emerson is kind of coming on strong when he's defending art. Science, Emerson says, is not sufficient to solve the deepest problems. When we contemplate the mysteries of life, poverty and labor and sleep, fear, fortune, Emerson says, we should turn to nature for the metaphors that help us to understand. This brings us back to the passage that I read earlier. Whilst the abstract question occupies your intellect, nature brings it in the concrete to be solved by your hands. So this abstract question, in our case, the injustice or social ill that you're dealing with, it's a barrier between human nature and goodness. When you can find an analogy out there in nature, out there in the physical world, when you study that natural phenomenon, Emerson tells us, you will find the wisdom of God. And with that wisdom, you can repair the damage to your soul. You can work a miracle that makes this world into a paradise. And you do that with language. Writing with those metaphors is real power because poetry speaks to us. It's not just a record of the poet's personal feelings, but it's a painstaking search for the natural metaphors that explain universal human problems and expresses it in concrete, specific images. Art distills nature. It breaks it down. It learns from it. It concentrates it into something, a potion, a spell, something powerful that we can use to solve those social problems that we can't solve unless we think about them, unless we explore them through metaphors, unless we write them in poetry. Okay, this concludes the pre-discussion podcast of Emerson's Nature. Happy reading, and I will see you in class.